Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Freedom of Species would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional owners of the land on which we broadcast today. We pay our respect to the elders of all of the lands on which we meet across Australia.
Welcome, welcome. You are listening to 3CR 855 AM and digital. This is Freedom of Species. My name is Meg. And here in the studio, live today, we have Ash. How are you, Ash?
I'm good, thank you, Megan.
Excellent. Now, so we just listened to Sal of Out of the Pan. Thanks for that, Sal. And Sal has a lovely interview voice and style. We really love Sal and Out of the Pan. So today we are talking about our subject for this show is the future of veganism. And it's a pretty casual chat. We're just going to have a chat about, you know, what we think. We're just going to be, you know, chatting about things, playing some audio, and really just discussing where veganism is going. Now, before we get into it, I actually want to play a little audio from Star Trek. This is just a funny little soundbite here, but, you know, we're talking about future and veganism. So we'll just...
perfect.
Exactly. We'll play this one.
Sorry to call you, sir. Not strictly security. It's about the dietary requirements of the Antican delegates.
I thought that had been taken care of in advance.
So did we, sir. Their live animals were beamed aboard. We were going to preserve the meat for them, but they say we must bring it to them alive.
Then do so. Lieutenant Yar was confused. We no longer enslave animals for food purposes.
But we have seen humans eat meat.
You've seen something as fresh and tasty as meat, but inorganically materialized out of patterns used by our transporters.
Sickly. Barbaric.
It's a bit of a turnaround, isn't it? To be called,
sounds
you know,
like when I'm cooking my vegan sausages at barbecue. Sorry.
No, so you know, it is. I mean, we will be talking about attitudinal changes and you know perceptions of veganism, etc. But what we wanted to do first was talk about the link between animal rights and a vegan lifestyle, because this show, Freedom of Species, is all about championing animal rights. Yeah. And, you know, we discuss animal rights all the time, and I personally feel that animal rights, championing animal rights and being vegan, living a vegan lifestyle is an ethically consistent way of living. And so you have this issue of if you are going to champion for the rights of individual animals and you're going to champion for them to not be used as, you know, food and clothing and, you know, being enslaved, etc., to be ethically consistent in your life, you do need to be adopting a vegan lifestyle, i.e. working towards a vegan lifestyle if you are not. That seems to me to be the only ethically consistent way of moving forward with animal rights. Yeah. So veganism and a vegan lifestyle is really, really important for us to get through, because even if someone isn't particularly interested in animal rights, if they adopt a vegan lifestyle, it's a lifestyle without exploitation of animals, and so they are really, you know, living that lifestyle and really, you know,
and
practically living it.
Contributing, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So today we're talking, as I said, about the future of veganism, and then we've got some interesting stats, we've got some really good sound bites, etc. And I think what we might do is have a look at, you know, delve into what's going on in the past to make sure that we have an idea of how much change that we've seen and how much change we've had, happen within, you know, the last decade, the last two decades, etc. Because it is really interesting to see the change that's happened. And from the point of view, so for myself, I've been vegan for almost 30 years. the change that I've seen, and sorry, we just had a little bit of a technical issue with Ashes.
Yeah.
You probably heard him, but he was a bit fuzzy, but now he's okay. We've sorted that all out. But the change that I've seen in almost 30 years of being vegan and looking at the world from a vegan lifestyle and a vegan view, philosophically, ethically, practically, has been massive. It's been massive. I mean, I can talk about all the individual stories about, you know, how hard it was to get vegan food in restaurants and grocery stores, etc. But just trust me, it was completely different to what it is now. Now, Ash, I think
I think I'm one of the lucky ones that came in at the peak. So, you know, roughly 10-ish years. And, yeah, everything, you know, you find you've got some leftover fruit or veg and you go, okay, what vegan recipe suits this, you know, and you just look it up on the net and it's there. So,
yeah, so everything like, you know, that is on the net. It 20 wasn't years ago, for us.
15 years ago, yeah, it probably wasn't there.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I still have a large collection of vegan recipe books that I never use, and I probably should disseminate them. But yeah, so it's been very interesting. And also one of the things that we want to touch on as well is the fact that change occurs, and change occurs through generational change as well. I think that a lot of the permanent change that we see is happening generationally. And so if we look, and we did a bit of research before this, it is a casual chat, but we have done some research, and we keep getting this, you know, this idea that the younger generations are more open to a vegan lifestyle. So even if they're not vegan or adopting a vegan lifestyle, they are open to the idea of eating vegan food. They're open to the idea, or they're more favourably looking upon a vegan lifestyle and vegan products.
I think there's just a wider acceptance for different lifestyles in that younger
in
generation.
General,
yeah, in general. So not veganism just fits into that, yeah.
Exactly. And I think, yeah, so it's ethically sort of, you know, it philosophically it fits into their acceptance you know, a host of different lifestyles and being
environmental,
more compassionate.
Compassionate, yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, just doing the research and having a look at that, it pans out with the statistics. And, you know, Gen Z is the generation that seems to have the largest uptake of veganism, but also the most positive perception of a vegan lifestyle, which is, it was fantastic. I mean, if you have a look at it, and as I said, you have a look at the change. And we did, and I've got some audio today. And what I wanted to do was make sure that I wasn't getting this audio from, you know, because you go on YouTube
you
and you're like, the future of veganism, it's like, you know, all of these right-wing pundits are going like, oh, veganism is dead, it's dying, it's terrible, it's unsustainable. And then, of course, you know, you've got, you know, the vegan channels that are like, you know, veganism will solve all the world's problems and it's the way
it's
of the future.
Only
and
we're,
it's the only answer in everything. And so what we wanted to do was get a few, you know, some audio that actually reflected maybe some kind of, maybe not middle ground, but something that wasn't just the two ends of the spectrum. And, you know, because we know that, you know, obviously there's a lot of people out there who are really championing the idea that veganism is dead, but there's also, you know, a lot of people out there that who are championing that the veganism is the only problem, only the solution to all of the problems, you know. And we kind of, we understand that there's a lot of nuance in this, and we also understand that in order to have this open discussion about veganism, we can't just talk about this ourselves as vegans.
No.
So change, and we were talking about this before the show, the reality is that change towards a more vegan and ethical lifestyle is not going to occur. This change is not going to be driven by vegans. It's going to be driven by the non-vegans in the world, changing their attitudes, changing their behaviours, their lifestyles, their diets, etc. That's where it's going to come from. And there's a whole bunch of different kind of drivers that are going to push that. You know, there's the economics of it. There's the health implication of it. There's the, you know, there's the environmental cost of it. And all of those things are going to be outside drivers that change our food networks, that change our perception of food. And so I think probably on that note, I might go to the first audio that we have. So this is a this is an audio by The Economist. It's entitled The Future of Veganism. And it was done about 2020. And we'll talk about it afterwards. It basically goes into this idea, and we keep coming across this in the research. There's all of these predictions about 2050. How is veganism going to be in 2050? And that is shown in this Economist audio. So here we go.
By 2050, the world's population could approach 10 billion. And around 60% more food could be needed to feed everyone.
The environmental impacts of the food system are daunting. It's responsible for about a quarter of all greenhouse gas emissions. It uses about 70% of all freshwater resources, and it occupies about 40% of the Earth's land surface. Food-related emissions could increase to 50% by 2050 and fill up the total emissions budget that we have in order to avoid dangerous levels of climate change.
Interest in vegan food has been booming across the rich world. A major study has put the diet to the test, analysing an imagined scenario in which the world goes vegan by 2050.
If everybody went vegan by 2050, we estimated that the food-related greenhouse gas emissions could be reduced by three quarters.
Cows are the biggest emission contributors. Bugs in their digestive system produce methane, and deforestation for their pasture releases carbon dioxide. These gases warm the planet. If cows were a country, they'd be the third largest greenhouse gas emitter.
I'm a ninth-generation farmer in this area. I grew up on a farm with cows and fattening bulls.
Jaap Korteweg comes from a long line of farmers in the Netherlands.
My goal is to be the biggest butcher in the world. We do it for meat lovers, but if you don't like meat, don't buy our products.
But he's now a butcher with a difference.
I'm the vegetarian butcher. We are hooked on the taste of meat. So the only way to change it is to develop products with the same experience without an animal. We can produce beef as big as a front door with the right texture of real beef. The equipment we used in our plant-based plant is the same as in a meat factory. The only difference is there was no blood on the floor.
Jaap made the switch to plant-based meat 11 years ago. He now ships to 17 countries with annual sales of 20 million euros.
The ingredients we use are different. We use soy, we use lupine, we use wheat, we use peas. We look to the meat product we want to copy and look for the right ingredients to get the same experience.
Farmed animals are land hungry. Over 80% of the world's farmland is used for animal production, but it produces only 18% of the world's calories.
You need to feed a cow about 10 kilograms of mostly grains for it to grow by 1 kilogram. For pigs, that's about 6 kilogram, and for chicken, 3 to 4 kilogram. So a lot of food is wasted as feed for animals that we would then eat.
Growing animal feed means more land per calorie of food is needed to produce beef than broccoli.
Two-thirds of all agricultural land is used as pastures. And if you saved all those pastures, if people went vegan, then that would be the size of the continent of Africa that would be freed.
And a well-balanced vegan diet, more varied with less calories, could save lives.
If the world went vegan in 2050, we estimated that premature mortality and also all-cause mortality could be reduced by about 20%.
Which could make the global economy healthier too.
We know how much money is used to treat certain diseases that are associated with diets, coronary heart disease, or stroke, cancer, and diabetes. Then we get to an estimate about $1 trillion US dollars in 2050 that could be saved. That would be about 3% of all global healthcare related costs.
But global meat consumption is growing around the world, by almost 3% a year since 1960.
Nobody liked the way we treat animals in factory farms. Nobody liked the situation that is not good for our health, not good for the environment, but we all like meat very much.
While Yap's firm threatens meat farmers, meat companies and butchers are customers and partners.
Meat companies don't own the farmers, so it's easy to change from chickens or pigs to plant-based meat. If the consumers want it and the market want it, they're happy to change.
Affordable and accessible alternatives could yet see the rich world hit peak meat and head down the other side.
If we look at past trends, it's probably unlikely to assume that the world would really go vegan by 2050. We found that without large-scale dietary changes towards more plant-based diets, we would have a very slim chance of staying below dangerous levels of climate change.
But even moving towards a plant-based diet could help.
According to our estimates, a predominantly plant-based diet could get us probably three quarters of the way. Governments can play a crucial role by setting the right dietary guidelines. They can adopt procurement policies where it's clear that the standard foods that are ordered are plant-based, healthy and sustainable.
For the vegetarian butcher, plant-based meat is just the next step in a long history of developments in the farming world.
It's always changing in the agricultural world. 100 years ago, there were millions of draft horses to transport, to plow. Now they are threatened with extinction because we don't need workhorses anymore. In the future, we will use machines to produce our meat, and the slaughter animals will be threatened with extinction too. And we only had room for wild chicken and wild pigs. And that's the future, I hope.
And there you have it, The Economist audio, How Veganism Can Change the World. So that was from an economic point of view, which we believe is going to be quite a significant driver towards a vegan lifestyle. You know, the economics of producing vegan food and vegan products, etc., are going to be a significant driver in the choices that people make. So, you know, we were talking about the fact that non-vegan people are going to be driving this change towards a vegan world with their consumer choices, as well as obviously, you know, their ethical and philosophical, you know, the thoughts and feelings and the changes that we are going through both individually and generationally. So, you know, we showed that idea of, you know, there's a lot of predictions of what's going to happen in 2050, which is 25 years from now. So that's, you know, that's a generational change, essentially. Mm. And I think sticking to that 2050, that sort of prediction scenario, I think you had some information.
Yeah, so I did a bit of hunting around, and the forecast for the plant-based market for 2050, they're talking about $1.4 trillion by 2050.
That's the whole of
the whole market. Now, the actual meat-based market, like so basically plant-based products taking the meat-based market, it was a bit of conflicting information. The first thing I looked up sort of stated it was around by 2050 they're going to have about a 25% market share, basically, of the meat market.
Of the traditional meat market.
Will be plant-based. But then I found some other studies, and it depends on the – it's very regional specific. So the Asia-Pacific region that we're in now, I found quite a bit of data stating that it was already at about 23% in our area. So obviously other areas have got quite a low percentage, and then others have a higher, but it's around that. The bigger sides are all around the 20% mark, but then there's a few other large continents that have a lower percentage. So, but yeah, it's interesting to see where that's going to go. And I think that's, you know, I mean, this whole, the future is the way the it's going to go with the money side of things. I think that's going to be a very influential thing. I think because, I mean, at the end of the day, I hate to say it, but a lot of things are driven by greed. And if companies can see value or a way of making these products that saves them money as opposed to the meat product, then there's going to be a shift.
And it's making the money and there's a demand.
Yeah, and then there's going to be a shift. That's going to be a, you know, that's, yeah, because at the end of the day, the shareholders, you know, it comes back to that sort of thing of a big company are going to go, okay, we need to, you know, they always want to make more money.
Mm, yeah, so, I mean, the economics is driven by that drive to make money in so this
capitalist
world. So
there's got to be a point where the land, the manpower to or the people power to produce these products.
The resources like
the
water.
Animals. Yeah, the water. Yeah, exactly. Mm. So, you know, yeah, I think that's going to be a big change.
And I think in the end, we have a situation where the consumer will, I mean, we all know that at the moment, you know, times are quite tight. You know, wages are stagnating, the cost of living is rising, etc. More and more people are making decisions based on economics. Mm. And that is, as I said, a huge driver. So I think that when we get to the point where we've got, you know, a kilogram of the average plant-based meat that is, you know, just as delicious and nutritionally balanced, and then a kilogram of the average meat, when that plant-based meat becomes significantly cheaper, there's going to be an economic decision that each and every individual consumer is going to make. And what do you put on the table that makes your food stretch more?
Yeah.
If it's
and that's
as
what
tasty,
it comes, you know, if you're making a spaghetti bolognese, you know, and you're putting a mince in there, you know, what's it made of and what's the cost? You know, we're all trying to save a bit of money. If it's just as nutritional, you know, I think it's actually going to be a case of the meat product will come up to the plant-based product as opposed to it. The plant-based, you know, I kind of feel
so
like...
So you think it's actually going to, the cost of living is going to rise so much that the impact, that the meat cost
and
is going to come
up. Isn't it? Yeah. It's just whether the plant-based gets pushed up with it. But I feel like, you know, I feel like, cost of living, like we keep saying.
Mm. Well, the reality is that with the onset of mass manufacturing of a product, the unit price goes down.
Mm.
And at the moment, we're still looking at small plant manufacture of a lot of these plant-based products. So they aren't coming up to this mass manufacturing point that a lot of the meat-based products are at the moment. And when they hit that mass manufacturing point and that unit cost comes down, the question is, how much is it going to come down by?
Mm.
And is it going to be as competitive? And whether that is going to influence the consumer, which I believe it will, and the consumer has always. I mean, the worker is the one that's getting squeezed in this economic situation.
I'm not saying any of this is, it's necessarily the best way, but it's an interesting, I think it's a very interesting angle to look at it from, you know, because it's unfortunately, things are driven by different things, and it's all good to say, well, we're going to be all, you know, it's only going to be vegan businesses benefiting from vegan food, but we've already seen large companies, dairy and meat companies adopting it.
And whilst, you know, a lot of us would feel ethically conflicted about buying products from them, I think that it is a positive change in that they are seeing this now as a viable economic option.
Mm.
And that is probably one of the most important significant milestones in actually making a vegan lifestyle more accessible from an economic point of view.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, that economist, you know, it was really coming from that economic point of view, which we do need to consider. I think probably at this point in time we'll go to a song. Now, so I've actually picked the Melbourne-based band Dead Can Dance. So it's an oldie but a goodie. I really loved this band in my goth nightclub days. The first song that we're going to play is Opium, and then we'll come back and we'll continue this chat.
Freedom of Species thanks Animal Free Science Advocacy for their financial support of this program. Animal Free Science Advocacy works to create a future where no animals are harmed in the name of science, and scientific progress is advanced through animal-free research methods. Become a member today by visiting animalfreesci.org.au.
That's animalfreesci.org.au.
Freedom of Species would like to thank Project Fresh Start for their financial support of this program. Project Fresh Start provides free plant-based food to the community, with a focus on providing healthy, fresh plant-based food and education around healthy eating and living in a way that sustains the individual, the community, the animals, and the planet. To find out more about our community lunches and programs, check out projectfreshstart.org.au.
Welcome back. You are listening to 3CR and the show is Freedom of Species. My name is Meg and here in the studio we have Ash. The song that you just listened to was Opium by Dead Can Dance, and you heard community service announcements by our two sponsors, Animal Free Science Advocacy and Project Fresh Start. We thank our sponsors very much for helping us continue to put our voices out there and champion animals and ethical lifestyles. So today we are talking about the future of veganism. Now, previously we heard an audio from The Economist about how veganism could change the world. It was very much focused on an economic standpoint, the reduction in costs of, production of resources, the reduction in costs of things like disease management from lifestyle changes, etc. But obviously, as we know, there are many barriers to adopting a vegan lifestyle, from the perception of vegans and a vegan lifestyle to cultural barriers or perceived cultural barriers, etc. We have an audio now. It's a La Trobe University panel back in 2018. It was called Diet and Identity, The Rise of Veganism. And it is consisting of a number of different panelists, both vegan and non-vegan, and talking about some of these barriers that are, that we have in front of us, between us and adopting a vegan lifestyle for our entire society. So we'll go to that, and then we'll come back. We'll actually go to a song after that. So the next song after that is Amnesia, again by Dead Can Dance. And we shall break down those the discussion that they had on the panel, and we will go through the arguments one by one and sort of tease them out and about their validity or, maybe not so much a valid argument. But as I said, there are people on that panel that aren't vegan. They're approaching it from a non-vegan point of view, which we do value because we need to hear these points of view in order to understand the situation as a whole. So here is Diet and Identity, The Rise of Veganism.
But in terms of the strong emotions, so there's a lot of things that come into play on both sides here. So for people who are eating meat who get really upset at the idea of vegans kind of forcing their views on them. So for a lot of people, eating meat is a really important part of family traditions. It's associated with celebrations, with good times, things like the Sunday roast or the barbecue. And they're very, really reluctant to give up those sort of activities, those sort of memories that are associated with that. But at the same time, if we look into anthropology, humans have a long history of a really ambivalent relationship with meat. So in most cultures, meat is the most highly prized category of food, associated with the most status and prestige, but it's often the most tabooed, the one that people are the most kind of uneasy about. So often slaughterhouses are kind of pushed to the outskirts of cities. People don't really want to know, for the most part, where their meat is coming from. People would probably much rather go on a tour of a chocolate factory than, say, a sausage factory. You can probably guess why. And there's quite a bit of research showing that just reading about vegans or vegetarians causes a lot of meat eaters to feel defensive and to increase their justifications for why they're eating animals than if you don't have them thinking about them. And that's part of what some psychologists at Stanford have called do-gooder derogation. So the idea is that if somebody else is doing something that you think is a good thing on some level, but you yourself are not doing it, yes, you'll give them props, but you'll put them down in some other sort of aspect. So there's a lot of research showing that meat eaters, on average, perceive vegetarians and vegans as being very ethical and principled, but sentimental, weak, wishy-washy, kind of bleeding hearts. And this is directly related to how much they think the vegetarians are judging them for what they're doing. even though the research shows that there's a lot less of that going on than people think. So that's the one side of it. And on the vegan side, why so many vegans get really worked up and there's the stereotype of the angry vegan activist is, I mean, we all know them. Some of us may have been them at some point, is that for a lot of vegans, the decision is made on really strongly held ethical principles that we don't want to be killing or exploiting animals, that we want to reduce the amount of suffering that we're causing in the world. And for a lot of vegans, when you see meat, when you see people eating meat, you're very much reminded of the link between the meat and how it was made and how the animal probably died in most cases, because most of them are going to abattoirs and not, you know, getting assassinated on that Danish island. So
don't go for a walk on that Danish island. You don't.
Yeah. So it can very much be a reminder that, you know, this is happening, and you see people around you who are eating these products without any sort of visible concern for where that's coming from, and that can be quite frustrating. So both sides can get really quite heated about this, and the two just kind of feed into one another.
Not to mention your first argument, which is, why are you differentiating between animals you love and animals you eat? Mm-hmm. That's a really strong argument. Why are dogs and cats so prized?
Yes, people get really worked up when they find out that there's these cultural festivals in other countries where people are killing dogs and eating them, and they're outraged, and yet worse treatment is happening to animals on some factory farms with similar emotional capacities, and, oh, well, they're just raised for us to eat, so let's not worry about that.
But food is also very much a function of cultural identity, and therefore to tell someone that their choice is wrong is to tell them that their culture is in some way inferior or wrong. And that can be really difficult. I mean, I've spent a fair bit of time in Brazil in recent years, and mm-hmm. tell most Brazilians that they can't eat Brazilian barbecue, and they will be very upset at you suggesting that they are doing anything other than what is natural to a Brazilian. So I want to throw this open to the panel, but how do you deal with issues of cultural identity where food is central to people's understanding of who they are, and meat is at the center of that?
For us, it's finding alternatives. So I am really privileged to be in a business relationship with a true creative chef who says, give me what your favorite family dish was, and she recreates it almost sometimes, I'm sorry to say it, but better. And I say sorry because she made a better matzo ball soup than my grandma made. Sorry, grandma, but it's true, and that's the thing. There is an alternative out there. I know I'm in a privileged position to have a personal chef to tell me, what do you miss? What can I recreate for you? But there are alternatives out there for literally every single thing. And we've been interviewed far and wide about what are you missing in your Christmas dinner, and do you have to have a roast at the middle of the table and things. You know, I'm not saying that culture is wrong. Let's give them the Brazilian roast, but vegan version. Let's do it.
Joan?
Am I the only person who finds it a little bit odd that you would want to be a vegan but still think you're eating meat? Like, I find it odd that if you're going to choose to be vegan, why do you want a burger that pretends it's bleeding blood? Because it's got beetroot juice. I find that really odd.
Vegans aren't going vegan because they don't like the taste of meat.
Okay.
Not all of them.
Yeah.
I reckon there's the... Here's a story for you. In the summer of 1968, a meteorite crashed down near Murchison, and the scientists from around the world scrambled to find that meteorite. And in it were organic compounds, as water, but there was also amino acids. One of them was glutamic acid. And they walked away from this, and they decided this could be where life on Earth started. The building blocks of life itself could have come from outer space. Glutamic acid is one of those building blocks. On your tongue, you've got sensors that are hardwired to detect salt, sugar, bitter compounds, sourness, and glutamic acid as well. It's delicious. It tastes delicious. Glutamic acid tastes delicious. And it's generally found in our food source in and around meat. Also, there's other compounds called guanylate and isocyanate, and they're found around fish. We are hardwired to discover deliciousness and deliciousness around meat. It's part of our hardwiring. But culturally, we've been able to synthesize or concentrate. Let's call that thing deliciousness, okay? Can we agree on that term, deliciousness? Just building on your argument there before. Deliciousness. We create that by taking milk and breaking it down using enzymes produced by bacteria to make cheese. And during the Roman Catholic Church's dominion over the Northern Hemisphere during the Dark Middle Ages, they had, 4 days and seven were days where you were had to fast, you weren't allowed to eat meat. And so these cheeses, washed rind cheeses developed that were very, very meaty. They're just full of glutamic acid. But the other way we create deliciousness in food is, who hears Italian or Spanish here? Sofrito? Sofrito, taking things, or like mirepoix in French, you take your carrots, your onions, your celery, perhaps some tomato, you cook it down, and you cook it down, and down, and down, and down, and down, and down. Just say there's 90 milligrams of glutamic acid in a tomato, in a ripe tomato. If you dry it out, it becomes 160 milligrams. Per 100 grams. When you start reducing food down, you start reducing food down and making it more and more concentrated using these traditional cooking methods, you create deliciousness that is plant-based. It's plant-based deliciousness. And the funny thing is, the really, really funny thing is that that glutamic acid's really, really strong in mother's milk, particularly in colostrum. And I really find it funny that the mums of the house have got this link with their children. They give them deliciousness in their first couple of days, and then they continue to do that in traditional communities when you have these beautiful dishes made with these cooked down beginnings of the dish, like sofrito and mirepoix, that they continue to hold the family together around the family dinner by offering them more and more deliciousness. It is part of our very own culture, and it is plant-based nutrition. And it's, even though it's cooked down, and then you add more vegetables, etc., to it. Mm-hmm. But you don't. There's really a lot of those dishes don't even require meat.
So there's a lot of this, as you've pointed out. Everyone here has pointed out the advantages and the blue sky for plant-based diets. But what we don't have is a dialogue across tribes. So we have vegans and people who identify as vegans or vegetarians and those who don't. What's the common ground in which we can share? Because if food is a function of identity, and we are now in the age of tribal wars, where people sort of coalesce around the tribe that they identify with and judge those that they are not, how do we start to build a common ground where both sides will listen to one another? Because it seems at the moment that that isn't possible. Matthew, we'll start with you, and then we'll come across.
And I'm very happy to kind of bounce back and forth in the two of us as well. So I don't think that we need to be locked into a tribal warfare by any account. I think sometimes that happens, and that's unfortunate. I think we probably have more in common than separates us in terms of what we're valuing. So we may be making very different decisions on what we're eating, but at the core of it, you know, most people really care about food. Food is a very meaningful part of their life. Some of our own research has shown that there are kind of five major domains of meaning that would be shared whether you're vegan or not. So food has a very strong social meaning, so sharing food with others, making you feel closer with them. A very strong health meaning, so for a lot of people, eating foods that nourish them is a very meaningful activity. For a lot of people, food has aesthetic meaning, so eating a really well-presented meal or really creative meal is an artistic experience that people value. For a lot of people, there's a spiritual meaning involved in it as well, so whether they're following religious tenets or trying to reduce the amount of harm that they're doing, etc.
And then there's the moral meaning,
and the rituals involved in that. So you have specific foods that are eaten at certain religious ceremonies, depending on one's culture, that are really important and integral to that, or certain religions avoid eating certain foods because of particular spiritual principles. And then there's the moral meaning of food, which is probably where the most sort of conflict happens. But I think that there's probably going to be less of this conflict as time goes on, because you can still have your delicious food that is like what you grew up with. It just happens to not be made from animals anymore.
But
I
it
really
is
think we're heading in that direction.
It is a political battleground, isn't it? If you go to one extreme where people might believe that the animals on the earth were given to us to be under our dominion, to be used as we see fit, it's pretty hard to convince someone whose belief system is based in that veganism is for them.
I'd say that's extremely old school, and like everything, I mean, it's the for me, it's the people that don't believe in climate change. So,
right.
I mean, really, if you're saying that animals are here on the earth, then treat them the way that Rich's family treated them. Don't put them in abattoirs. Mm-hmm. I think that that's the basic fundamental difference. I think there'd be a lot more consciousness around eating meat if animals were actually treated ethically, and that's what that animals on the earth argument, and we hear it all the time as vegans, all the time. But for me, and for my physical capacity, it's creating positive experiences and spaces around veganism. And I always say,
how do you do that? How are you doing that at the moment?
I'm doing it because you can walk into the restaurant and you have no idea you're in a vegan restaurant. Why do we have to put a definition on vegan restaurants must have slaughterhouse footage and an angry hippie with dreadlocks giving you pamphlets at the door and veggie stacks? Like, why was that the manual to opening a place that serves plant-based food? I have no idea. But some people, like I said before, have negative conceptions because that was their one experience with vegan food. So if you created an environment that's unlike anywhere else, we're a bustling Fitzroy restaurant that serves cocktails and great music and really great service, that person can come in and be not confronted, not alienated, and they can see that this plant-based diet is, oh, there's something to it. So I think it's all about positivity and not alienating and making people feel like, why wouldn't I make, you know, and it's how Shannon creates food. If I can make roast beef and I can make a vegan roast beef and it's the exact same in flavor, why wouldn't I just do this? So if I can eat a meal at a restaurant and it's no different than the place down the road, why wouldn't I just continue to eat at that place that happens to tick all these other boxes?
Welcome back. You're listening to 3CR and Freedom of Species. We've been talking about the future of veganism, talking about it from an economic standpoint, a cultural standpoint, and a whole bunch of different standpoints, including obviously the basis that we have for Freedom of Species, which is the animal rights standpoint. Because as we've mentioned, we believe that change is going to come from the non-vegan community. These are the people that we need to influence, and this is where we need to build that positivity towards, that vegan lifestyle. So we heard about, we listened to the panel, the La Trobe University panel, Diet and Identity, The Rise of Veganism. And we just want to make a little bit of a correction there. I kind of feel like, so one of the panelists was talking about this term deliciousness that he'd coined, but we do actually want to let listeners note that there is actually a word for that. It's called umami, which is a Japanese term for the fifth basic taste. It's the savory taste, so sweet, sour, bitter, salt. And I kind of felt like we needed to say that because, you know, I think he's just kind of glossed over the fact that Japan has actually coined this term and has this, it's a very common thing, that's spoken of. But, we're just looking in general at the trajectory of how we're going as a society. You know, we're looking at generational change. We're looking at individual change. We're looking at stats from a capitalist point of view. We're looking at all of these changes that are coming along. And really, we have some massively positive data coming in. And, this whole idea of accepting and being accepting of a vegan diet and lifestyle, and more people adopting a vegan diet and lifestyle. Maybe we won't get there by 2050, but, maybe we will. Maybe we will have a society that looks favorably upon that by that time. Mm. But we just have to keep working, but we have to change the hearts and the minds of people who already, they haven't been changed yet. So we're going to go to our last song. It's the end of the show. Thanks for listening. The last song is The Carnival Is Over by Dead Can Dance. Stick around because the music show Rotations is up next. Thanks again.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.